I'm just the facilitator up here. I know a little bit about big data, but the people that really know more about this are, first of all, John Shanahan from DuPont Pioneer, is one of the session chairs, and then also Brenda Ortiz from Auburn University. And so they were instrumental. We had several conferences calls where we planned the session to make sure that we had an opportunity to get the best knowledge in front of you and for an opportunity for discussion and interaction. So, Peter, I've known you for a number of years. You're with the Iowa Soybean Association, and we will look forward to hearing what you have to say here today.
Thank you, Bruce, for the nice introduction, and welcome to this presentation and very important and timely symposium. Welcome. Excuse me. Sorry. My story today is how we can squeeze useful information from this data. And the example is going to be from the Iowa Soybean Association on Farm Network. It's a farmer-led group. There are several similar groups across country, especially Midwest, Nebraska, Indiana, Ohio. There is going to be one in Missouri. But the general objective of these groups, these farmer networks, is to use different precision ag technologies to test different products, technologies, and practices. We also stress in Iowa that we want to be the third party of provider, information provider for farmers. And also, we stress that we want to be farmer the part of this research network. They are not only passive data providers. They are like graduate students or researchers. So again, my name is here, but this is work of hundreds and thousands of farmers across Iowa, some researchers, both from industry and universities. As NETWORK was established 15 years ago, the data stewardship model was relatively simple. The previous speaker told about the issue with privacy and so on. The farmers own data, they control data. Location and names are protected. We never reveal them. But field and summary are publicly available online. I'll show you later. And also data are used in science, both for farmer-friendly publication and for scientific publication, which I work a lot. And finally, because of our relationship with farmers, we often ask to help other groups across country to manage and curate the data. The general model of data processes and analysis decision is in fall. Here on the top, we have three different data sources. One, it's a state or watershed-wide surveys. Those either nutrients or some kind of related to disease or pest management. The second source of data are on-farm replicated strip trials. Those are specific design experiments, which I'll explain you later. And finally, there is another group, in addition to on-farm network, it's called Environmental Programming Services. That group is focused on water quality, environmental assessment, plus life cycle analysis. So all of this data are funneled to the data hub or research database. And of course, we spend a lot of time cleaning this data, processing both in-house and outside. The analytics come from both from individual field summaries and so-called multilevel data analysis, which I'll explain later. The information delivery or decisions come from four different blocks. One, it's an online database of field-level reports, which I'll describe later. The spatial crop budgeting or profit zone management. The last one is online profitability and risk calculators, which I'll give you some example. And finally, we also playing with crop system modeling as an additional tool to put all this information in as a one system, crop production system. So focus on a statewide nutrient or statewide survey. Surveys are very important because even Iowa, even if you have two or three crops, management, weather, soils in Iowa are extremely variable. So this is an example of one of the nutrient survey. Focus on nitrogen assessment. This is on nutrients, nitrogen assessment, and so on. So we use this survey to target the heart or target area. So one of the examples is based on nitrogen. Of course, we Iowa soybean, but we also work with corn. And this is an example of one of the decision tools. It's a risk calculator. It's an applet which will be released very soon. Based on this historical data, thousands of fields, this is from this part of the Iowa, the user can enter timing, form, rates, and then the calculator will connect to real-time weather and will give a probability to be deficient on excess. So it's a type of risk assessment based on this type of data. And again, these are survey data. We also, the core our business are replicated strip trials. And Tristan Mueller, he's in the back, he works with farmer side on side. He's in front line. And just recently we published this publication focused on replicated strip trials. The idea is to help farmers to understand what do we mean by conducting these trials. And those are relatively simple, practical, and relevant, usually 2, 3, maximum 4 treatments. And we focus both on different types of basic and applied research questions. I mentioned that all of these field-level summaries are online. You can go online, and they're historical for all crops, different practices, different projects. They're online. You can go in Google. And each of these reports, it has 4 pages, but the most important are these are experimental units results. So you won't find this in scientific publication. So you can calculate your own statistic, some basic management information, some weather, and so on. So these are allows farmers to make some basic management decisions. Of course, Ian mentioned about predictive analytics. It was a couple years ago, before people started talking about predictive analytics, we had a group of farmers, and it was a time when farmers started using fungicide on soybean. You probably know what was the cause as a threat of soybean rust, but they started using this fungicide. Of course, a lot of time we don't have disease. And farmers told us, you guys should develop some kind of calculator, because every time you go to your supplier or agronomist, they always tell us something different. As we started collecting data, we realized that we don't have enough data, but as we look at some relationship, and then we publish these results, we develop so-called fungicide calculator. So it's a very simple idea. You look at the stochastic relationship on yield response, and then it spits you basic idea based on rainfall and prices of soybean and cost of fungicide, the profitability measure, and so on. So again, it's a very relatively simple idea of predictive analytics a couple years ago. Of course, the problem is that this fungicide changed so rapidly, so right now it's also obsolete. But again, this is idea of predictive analytics, which happened a couple years ago because of farmers asking. There are a lot of discussion about statistics. Statistics is very important, how to sort out this big data, messy data. And if you read scientific journals, you probably notice that some of the journals actually put a ban on using p-value for null hypothesis. Yeah, you probably saw this. And the problem we realized a couple years ago that this is a very simple example, just a couple trials. Again, this is comparison of narrow row spacing for soybean and wide, and this is yield response to narrow row spacing. And this is a common problem in this type of experiment, that usually these results, responses are not significant. But the question is, how can you make decisions about this? So one of the solutions to this is to completely move away from and decide something else using different types of analysis like partial pooling and shrinkage. So even if this farmer, he saw this result, he had to pull some data from other. He had to borrow some information to make some decision. And of course, it's not one number, it's a distribution. But if this farmer participated in these trials, it's better to use this data. If he doesn't, it's better to use population level data. So again, this predictive analytics stuff required different type of thinking and analysis, how to make this data more accessible to farmer and more comprehensive. I mentioned that the strip trial, on-farm strip trial, the most important part of our what we do. And very often we deal with dilemma of so-called multi-level analysis. We have both spatial data, a lot of hundreds of different layers, soil, weather, management, whatever you call it. We deal with responses in space. So the question is how you can separate this analysis across different space, at different levels. So we're working with different groups, especially from Iowa State State Department, and a couple years ago we introduced the idea of using predictive distribution based on some kind of analysis Bayesian approach. But this type of predictive distribution, what's more useful for farmers is what would happen in new situation given the observed data. So this is a type of analysis. This is with soybean planting rate, how you can make this prediction based on observed data, both spatial and different levels in new situation. And again, this is another type of thinking, how to make this data more usable for farmers. I mentioned that this type of analysis focuses on different levels and different scales. It's still descriptive. It's empirical. It allows us to focus, connect some dots for cause and effect, but still, a lot of time we have missing information. A lot of time we have no information. So we also started working with crop system models. And this type of models allows to put all this stuff in one place. So it allows us to build the system, the cropping system. And we work with a group from Iowa State, and Mark here, Mark Licht, he is here. He is part of this group, Soterios Arkontolis group, where we try to put this data as a system. So here is an example. This farmer, he would test only two rates here in this optimal range. The question is, what would happen if you expand these rates using the model? What would happen if you make prediction for different timing of planting using historical weather? So you can clear here that if you use early planting, the yield is kind of larger, but look at this variability. Of course, if you use later planting, the yield is smaller, but variability less. So again, this is another idea how you can connect these dots in addition to descriptive analysis using the simulation models, which allows to focus more on what would happen in new unpredicted situation given the observed data. Of course, economics, it's a big deal. It's a critical issue, especially now with low prices for corn and soybean. Another piece of information we started playing with is focus on spatial crop budgeting or profit zone management. We are using one of the commercial tools. It's a tool developed by one of the company names called Exolver. So the idea is to collect specific information from farmer, like cost of seeds, price of rent land, price of rent land, fertilizer, input, machinery, all kind of information for specific fields and farms. And then using crop budgeting, we can make estimation of profit zones across several years based on different prices. And we can estimate return on investment for different prices, different scenario. But the most important part in my case, it's looking for variability in profit, right? Looking at the standard deviation, how does this profit changes over time? And why it changes? So again, we are trying to put together this type of multi-scale analysis and make estimation why in some places within fields the profitability is much lower. Or what happened if we know that price affects profitability. We know that spatial variability is important. But how about field level practices like management, tier, and so on? Again, so this is the example how we can connect these dots using different types of analysis from both descriptive, empirical, and modeling. So I would like to say that big data doesn't have very good connotation within the farmer community for different reasons, if you agree with me or not. But collecting data becoming much easier, that's true. Extracting useful information is not. So I believe that's why you came here. It's often happened that with this type of data, I would call messy data, not because they are messy, but because of different sources and ownership. Very often with large amount of data, your research question become larger too. And in the end of the day, this data become very small, very tiny. A year ago, with big data discussion in Iowa, there is a group called Iowa Ag State Group. It's a group of different businesses, suppliers, commodity groups, universities. They try to make some recommendation how we can handle the, how we can embrace this idea of big data. And one of the interesting conclusions from this Ag State Group was that there is no way separate industries or groups can handle all these issues. So the idea was to come up with some kind of data warehouse. It's a data warehouse that which can be owned by farmers but have a stake from both consultant, agronomist, machinery, ag input, even banks and landlords. Whether this happens or not, it's not sure, but still at this moment we are looking for different ways how to utilize this data and help farmers both make profit and be sustainable and move forward.
Okay, let's let Peter know how much we appreciate your presentation. Okay, so just a comment in regards to your last comment about the data warehouse. I was in Chicago yesterday at a meeting of the Agricultural Data Cooperative, which I know that they know about your discussions and the groups are talking. And so kind of an independent sort of a farmer-centric place where data can go and getting it formulated and chartered and trying to figure all that out. So this is the part of the meeting. We have 10 minutes here where you guys can do the talking. And these two gentlemen will do the responding. And so what issues, what things popped in your head when Peter made his presentation? And Yvonne, you're fair game up here too. So let's start here in the front row.
So you alluded to correlation and the dangers of causality. Mm-hmm. So having a big data set, one of the things I wonder is, should we just hand it to someone who knows nothing about the data, but simply knows how to look for patterns, and simply give it to someone who's completely agnostic in terms of what it can mean? So no hypothesis, just give them the data, say it's time series analysis, tell us what you see, or do we need to drive that by, does it need to be hypothesis driven from the start? Or
it does not have to be hypothesis driven, but don't let someone who doesn't know the context analyze the data. Well, maybe they can discover some patterns because they don't have a priori knowledge of what could happen.
Yeah.
That is interesting, but you will have to analyze their finding. Because, and I think that in all the fields I've been working on, the field of epidemiology with doctors and physicians is very well organized with regards to that, because they have those data centers and they have data scientists. Those data scientists are not physicians, although they know the vocabulary, they have some background, but they are not physicians, they are not doctors. Okay, and they are not nurses, but when they have a request from a doctor, for example, from an epidemiologist, they will first of all look at if that person has the right to ask for those data for that region, for that period. They will analyze the algorithm he wants to use, if it makes sense or not. They will look at the metadata. They have a lot of metadata, and they will look at if, for example, if you ask a question for the last 10 years, if the protocols have changed over those 10 years, so maybe the definition of one measurement has changed. And then they will inform the doctor about that. They will give him access to the data if he has the right to, but they will also inform him of potential problems of wrong interpretation of the data. So they are not specialists, as I said, in epidemiology, but they can understand the queries or the questions of the physicians and doctors, and they are filtering who can use it for what purpose. And that's the most advanced field of application that I have seen. And I think that we have a lot to learn from them.
So I think, could you direct your, is this for Yvonne or? For Peter, okay.
You mentioned that the farmer buy a fungicide and they have some questions they don't know. I just want to know how many farmers this time apply a fungicide, how frequently, what's their method of use determined to apply or not? What's the information we can have them to solve this problem?
The question was about the use of fungicide in different crops in Iowa, and Tristan can add, he is expert in that. But for soybean, the fungicide came to Iowa about 10 years ago, and right now it's probably about 20-25%, a little more acreage in Iowa for soybean applied with fungicide. Because they are used a lot of time, they're used promoted as a health, a plant health measure, and that was important of that project, which allows us to separate the effect, even if without disease, where these responses are possible.
Yeah. Okay, other questions here. Let's go here, and then we can do Chris. Go ahead, sir.
So I'm sorry. How do you structure those on-farm trials in terms of grower responsibility versus the grower responsibility and financially and data management and all that? How do you negotiate that with the growers?
The question was, what kind of financial responsibilities farmers have when they participate in these studies? Different projects have different structure. Most of the time, farmers, we have either product, we have either grant, both. We work as a research organization, we apply for state, different types of grant. Those grants cover these projects. Sometimes we have agreement with different industries, companies, and so it's the same way as you work at university. Often farmers would be paid for buying this product or for yield loss. Very often some of these experiments would produce yield loss, and we have to compensate them.
Okay, Chris, then direct your question to one of these two.
First speaker,
Chris. Yeah, Yvonne.
Okay, so I have a colleague I work with at Purdue, a computer engineering, that recently told me that based on the connections he has with the Silicon Valley companies, that between 2020 and 2025, they're very concerned that the pace of constructing or manufacturing hardware for data storage will not keep pace with the generation of big data. In light of that, how important is it going to be to sort of
profiling properly. Yeah.
Do you see a trend of work in that area increasing?
Well, what I would say with regards to that is there is a trend I see with profiling where at the beginning, there were a lot of people saying that, well, we should keep all the data that are coming in. And because, there are some of them that we don't know today if they have some value, but maybe in the near or far future, they will have some value. So let's keep all of that. But now more and more what you see is people just getting rid of those data that they don't see their usefulness today. So the number of data is reduced a lot. So it's still big data, but it's not as big as a lot of people were thinking about at the beginning. So that will surely help with what you just said. But that's the first time I hear about that. That's an interesting point of view. The other aspect is the more we rely on digital technology, at the same time, the less we rely on our own personal capabilities. And at a certain point, it can become a problem. For example, how many people, let's say below 40, have problems with mathematics because of the calculators? Nowadays, how many students are interested to learn something? Google knows everything. Okay? So they don't want to learn. They want to solve. Give me a problem. And then they go on the web They Google it and they try to find solutions. Okay? They don't want to learn. They don't need to. There is something there that knows everything. So there is always that danger that we rely too much on the technology. So storing the data is one challenge. And in some cases, from a legal point of view, the digital data are not considered valid. In other cases, if you are in a state or in a province, like in Quebec, for cadastral data, if you do some legal delineation of properties, if that data is sent to the cloud outside of the province, it is illegal. Okay? That kind of thing happens. So that means that there are certain ways of dealing with storing the data and probably keeping some hard copies somewhere. Not for all the data, that's impossible, but it's still useful.
Okay, I think we had a question here, sir.
Kind of feeds off of the last point there. I mean, in other industries, are there examples of this where a data warehouse exists, where across, you know, from an outside looking in, you see Google has their, healthcare has their, right? Do you see industry or outside our industry where this example exists and works? What are pros and cons of that?
It does exist in other industries. Most of the work I have done is with the transportation industry. Road networks for the province of British Columbia, the province of Quebec, the government of Canada, 911 systems and things like that. And they have data warehouses integrating data from various departments and from the police and from the insurance companies with regards to accidents and so on. It is a challenge. It is more an organizational challenge than a technical one, as in many projects. But the needs are so high to integrate those data, the benefits are so high that at the end they can overcome the problem. But it's not everywhere. But in that field, I see many data warehouses. And also when we think about data warehouses, a lot of projects use the word data warehouse, but it's simply an integration of data coming from various sources stored in a relational database. But it's not structured in a data cube as we do in ideal data warehouses, so they have slow performances, slow aggregation speeds, and slow geovisualization of the data. But if you use data cubes and BI technology and spatial OLAP technology, it's so much easier and faster. But most of them are not there yet. There is a real difference between what we hear about in, about the technology and the real efficient implementation of that in real life. There is almost a 10 to 15 years difference.
Time for one more question. Yes, sir. And for Peter or for...
Oh, for Peter.
Yes, very good.
So, I mean, you see... large data sets with patterns and structure, and sometimes I feel some of the methodologies we use are a little bit thinking about data sets that were not as dense. So as you have been looking at these data sets over and over again, have you seen that maybe there are other technical approaches or other analytics that can be used?
So,
For instance, when you run some of the responses to nitrogen in multiple fields in Iowa across years and so on, have you felt that some of the ways to look at those patterns might change as the type of data set you have?
So the question was, what kind of system of looking at this data, whether the system and analysis of analyzing data over time changes, as I understood you. I think that's a good point. I think they should change. And that's, they're not static. And as it's a continuous loop. It's a data collection, analysis, summarization, And again, and I want to address your question. I think without farmers, there is no way we can sort out a lot of different things, because only they know what really happened, regardless how much information we have, how much this information is accurate, and how much time we spend cleaning the data. So I think it's a closed loop of different stakeholders, farmers. And very often, as we as data analysts, I'm an agronomist and statistician, I would say, but often we data analysts, we treat data as a dead body, some kind of, I think data should have some live connotation, right? You have to understand that this field is coming from that farm, and I know that farmer, I know what he does, and of course, we work with agronomists, which really help us to sort this out. Otherwise, I know Google can do it, but... I don't see a lot of progress unless we connect all these dots as a system with farmers and data analysts and other people who can understand and contribute in different ways. Plus, economic information and social aspect are important too.
So, Peter, thank you. Yvonne, thank you. Let's give these gentlemen both another hand.